and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 29th of November 2015. My name's Telfy Watson, and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Gareth James, Tim from the Civilian Theatre, and Web Cowgirl. We're now going to talk about Evening at the Talk House, which is a play by Wallace Shawn, directed by Ian Rickson at the Dorfman Theatre, which is part of the National Theatre. This is a rather odd play, and I've split the critics a bit, and some people are giving it sort of 4 stars and saying they loved it, and other people as 1s, 2s, and I think one review is, I wouldn't give it any stars, or mice in her case, if Sinead Matthews hadn't been in it. So it has divided people. Essentially, we're in a parallel world where theatre is dead and the half-hour sitcom is now a serious art form, which is wherever all the actors gravitate to and everybody discusses them as if they are high art. It's also a world where we have targeted killings which are contracted out to the public. Anybody in the public can target people for assassination, and assassinations can either be bombings or can be done individually. These often look as if they're done to third world countries, but also they can be done much more locally, and it does look as if people are targeted for stepping out of line, although they don't exactly say what the line is, but it does look as if it can be sort of as simple as not obeying society's norms. Some of the people carrying out the killings are unemployed actors, because, well, you have to use unemployed actors, don't you? There are always unemployed actors around. There's also a question of people who are likely to be targeted. If they're stepping out of line and getting a bit too hyper or annoying, they can be at risk of being severely beaten by their friends. Whether friends has quotes around it or not, I'm not absolutely sure. But on the face of it, this play starts as a playwright talking about the death of theatre and a 10-year reunion at a place called The Talk House, which is a restaurant become club, which was often frequented by the theatre types when theatre was still alive. John, tell me more about this play and what you thought about it.
I'm glad you've explained so much of what it's about, because you've revealed more in that couple of minutes than I really got from most of the production. I have to confess to finding myself in the not entirely unfamiliar position of coming from behind, because I wasn't aware of the name or reputation of the man who both wrote and stars in this, Wallace Shawn. He's obviously an American actor whose appearances have been in a whole raft of TV shows that I just missed. I mean, I don't have cable and I won't give money to Murdoch, so there are a lot of channels that I'm just not exposed to. But he has that kind of impish, cheerful round face on a short, stocky body that makes you think he could be something out of a Star Wars movie. But he's apparently most famous as Alicia Silverstone's schoolteacher in Clueless. And either I've seen Clueless and forgotten it, or I've never seen it. And then when it cascaded into a television series and somebody else played the Alicia Silverstone part because she'd grown too big for it, he was still the schoolteacher. There you go. So he's also this rather offbeat, off-the-wall, kind of would-be Pinter sort of playwright. And I'm afraid also I haven't seen either of his two previous pieces, although I think you have, and you might want to come back in with some information about them. But here he is, in his own play at the National Theatre, and even though I'd never heard of him, I was willing to go. And I so wish I hadn't. Evening at the Talk House, it's a lovely title, and I'd love to go to this place called The Talk House, which is just the kind of under-commercialised eating and drinking den run by a kind of motherly hostess and proprietor played by Anna Calder Marshall. That I'd love to be at, you know, be a member of. It's a club you actually would want to join. But we start with this monologue recited by American actor Josh Hamilton, who is a stalled playwright but rather weirdly dressed as a geography teacher in a brown corduroy suit and a red V-neck sweater in this shabbily forgotten drinking club, talking about how theatre died and really painting what might have been a rather more interesting first act for us. Except it takes 17 minutes and that is far too much for a monologue. And it, you know, however good an actor he is or, you know, nice to look at, it just goes downhill from there. I also couldn't understand the location. It feels like it's a bit of, you know, the Hunger Games, or what's that other one called, District 7, where all society has died and there's mercenary shooting abroad. And you think that it ought to be America, because, you know, we're fairly sure America's society is going to break down before the rest of us. But it's an Anglo-American cast, and they all use their own accents. So I don't know what that's about, but then again, Rufus Norris, when do you know what it's about? It's also set in that abused cliche, a dystopian future. And as you say, theatre has died as an art form, and some of the ex-practitioners of theatre, in desperately trying to find something to do, have turned to this government-sponsored programme of identifying, researching and killing undesirables. And they've all cascaded into some other kind of job. You know, Annette, the wardrobe mistress, played by Natalie Werthner, a curious actress for me. I'm not sure I'm aware of her work, and she plays this large, gloomy, bankrupt woman with a sort of slightly strange, slightly theatrical costume, but also with a prosthetic leg, but an exposed prosthetic leg, which I assume is her own, although, you know, it's never mentioned in the play, and I don't know whether this is disability blind casting or whether it's a point and she actually had a real leg strapped up under her dress. I really couldn't get it. The only one of this crew of people who were once in a play called Midnight in a Clearing with Moon and Stars, and I just wondered if this was a glancing blow at David Eldridge and A Thousand Stars Explode in the Sky, which is also a very talky piece that ran at the Lyric Hammersmith really before he became more famous, and rightly so, for In Basildon. So you have this collection of, you know, it's like The Good Companions, you know, it's a group of actors who have been together 10 years ago in a piece and, you know, still rattle along as friends, gossiping about people they used to know, and they're not real people, so you're not aware of it, or they gossip about situations that they've all shared, and again, they're not exposed, you don't know what they're talking about, and you are meant to feel alienated from it. You have an interesting piece of casting in the man playing Tom, Simon Shepherd, who is now a hero of Josh Hamilton's television soap, and he's the one who is propagandizing for television as being the coming thing because, you know, he found theatre was dead. Well, that's rich for a man who's had such a checkered theatrical career himself. But then, you know, after the conclusion of the monologue and a little bit of chat between the two guys, Wallace Shawn himself pitches up, and he is this disheveled, possibly drunk, old has-been, who says he's been beaten up by some friends in just a short battering, just informal. And I'm sure it's meant to be an allegory or a metaphor for something, but I couldn't make out what. And he's got points to score about how easy it could be for people to sign up to state-sponsored vigilantism. And here we are possibly on the brink of the Third World War, and you could say it was glancingly topical in the sort of post-Paris shootings collective outrage. But it's all too muddled and too opaque for me, and, you know, the actors babble about the shows they were in, and they bitch about people that they used to know. You just don't get it. And there was obviously a sense of bafflement in the theatre. You know, even the people who didn't walk out were kind of checking their watches and rolling their eyes at each other. So it's not been a popular piece, either with the critics or the actors. And as for Sean saying he's been beaten up by people he claims as friends, well, you know, go to this and you'll know how he feels, because I like the National Theatre, but I don't expect to be beaten to a pulp for an hour or 40 minutes by something like this. It's just too earnest for its own good. If you have ideas like this to sell, then you've got to make the medium more palatable, otherwise people won't swallow it. And I think the best you can say is that the set could be reused for The Mousetrap, but what the ideas could be reused for, I really can't tell.
I should have said this earlier about Wallace Shawn, because I do know him quite a lot. To most people of my age who love the film The Princess Bride, he is, of course, the kidnapper of The Princess Bride of the title, and has a chess match with the hero and says words like inconceivable all the time. And it's something that is very memorable if you know that film. He also directed a film called My Dinner with Andre, which is him and a famous director called Andre, and they go to dinner together and they talk. Robert Key goes on about it a lot in his book Story, I believe. It's sort of held up as a very good way of structuring a film, and oddly enough, it's just two people talking. And for the Star Trek fans, he was, of course, the Grand Nagus, which is the leader of all the Ferengi. But I wouldn't expect you to know that, John, but he is quite famous. And in fact, I think I've seen four of his plays. He did a play called The Fever, which he did both as a monologue, and later Claire Higgins did it at the Royal Court a few years ago. Possibly his most successful play which was turned into a film was The Designated Mourner, which he starred in with Mike Nichols and Miranda Richardson, which was on at the Cottesloe, which has now become the Dorfman. And most recent work that he did was Grasses of a Thousand Colours, which was on at the upstairs at the Royal Court with Miranda Richardson and Jennifer Tilly. So
which he describes having sex with a cat?
I believe so, yes. So he's certainly somebody who is extremely well respected, and reading a lot of the reviews, the people who are nice about this play are being very respectful towards the ideas and giving his ideas a chance. But I do have to say, I kind of agree with you about the execution. It's tedious, and it's also there's not an awful lot of action. I mean, it is just people talking about other people and putting across ideas. And I think if you like the ideas and you like the strangeness of it, I mean, there is that very strange bit where they read from the play and you think, how was this ever a play? Because it's such a weird thing. I mean, it sounds like something fantasy Homer, because it sounds a little bit that Homeric, if you've ever read sort of the way that Homer is translated literally, almost a very flowery speech of that, but translated into a sort of much more of a fantasy element, perhaps making fun of that. And it didn't sound worth it. We get a rather interesting idea that there is a poison that the assassins use, and I really hoped that that's how the play would end, because they do describe the symptoms, and somebody seems to be suffering from the symptoms at one point, and you think, great, this is how the play is going to end, they're all going to be dead. And actually what we got at the end when I saw it was we got around about 30 seconds of silence after the blackout. People couldn't work out whether or not to clap. I've heard on Twitter that silence can last over a minute. So, yeah, I can understand the critics praising the ideas, because some of the ideas are quite interesting, but the actual play itself, it's not enjoyable, quite honestly. And I don't think it's particularly good. But you keep coming up back to, you know, I went over the reviews before we did this, and a lot of the reviews just loved it, just thought it's brilliant, and they just are in love with the ideas he puts across. Mm-hmm. So I think if you're prepared to go for the ideas and that's the sort of thing you love, then you might just like this play, but otherwise you might just have a fairly boring night, which I think is what we had. We're now going to talk about Little Eyolf, which is being done at the Almeida Theatre. This is played by Henrik Ibsen and has been adapted and directed by Richard Eyre. It stars Julian Coy, Sam Hazeldine, Lydia Leonard, Eve Ponsonby and Eileen Walsh, with various child actors to star as Little Eyolf. It's designed by Tim Hatley, and the play has been done not often before. I think the only time the play proper has been done even in any way recently was about, as ever, 18 years ago. The RSC did it with Damien Lewis in the cast, and I think Joanne Pierce as well. But an adaptation by Samuel Adamson called Mrs. Affleck was done 6 years ago at the National Theatre, where they translated the play to, instead of late 19th century Norway, it was 1950s the South Coast, an English seaside resort in the early 1950s, which was a bit weird when you have a woman coming along, or in this case I think it was a man coming along, and describing people being eaten by rats. It didn't sound quite right, but there you go. Gareth, tell me more about this production, what you thought of it.
Well, I'd just seen the play once before, so it's not a particularly familiar play to me. And as you say, it's a rarely performed Ibsen, it's a late Ibsen, and it's actually a very short Ibsen, in that it just comes in at about 80 minutes. Richard Eyre has adapted it, and I think the first thing to say about it is it just doesn't feel like a 120-year-old play, even though it's in kind of period costume. It sort of feels really quite fresh in terms of writing, and I think has a lot of psychological depth. And I found it devastating in a way, really emotional. emotionally kind of quite draining. I enjoyed it very much in that way, as it were. And it revolves around Eyolf's parents, Alfred and Rita, whose relationship is a bit rocky. Eyolf is something around 10, 12. He's disabled. And Rita feels really, I think, that their relationship is somehow Eyolf comes between them, and also Alfred's sister, Asta, comes between them. So it's a sort of rocky relationship. And when we begin the play, Alfred has just returned from a couple of weeks in the mountains, a sort of self-imposed solitude. And one of the things he's determined to do when he comes back is to devote more time and energy to his son. But then there's a tragedy, and I don't think it's spoiling it to say that Eyolf dies. And then the three adults during that period of grieving, together with Bjorn, who is wooing Asta, Alfred's sister, the kind of relationships between them unfold. And the relationships, I mean, they're quite complex relationships between Alfred and his sister, between Rita and Alfred, and indeed between Asta and Bjorn. And it does pack a lot for me into 80 minutes. And I just thought it had great, it kind of unfolded a bit like a thriller, really. I mean, it looked, set, drew you in. In addition to Tim Hatley's sort of very simple but very elegant design, there's great projections by John Driscoll, and there's a bit of lighting by Peter Mumford, and there's a soundscape by John Lennon. All of them add together to kind of take you to the outer world in which they live. So you've got this quite small space, a sort of terrace outside their house where it all happens. But then this design kind of shows you, you know, that there's a world out there where it's all happening. So I thought it was very good indeed. I've seen all the actors before one way or another, but for some reason they all blew me away that night, and I think that could be because Richard Auerstee's particularly good performances out of them, and the two I'd single out would be the ladies, really. I thought Lydia Leonard was just terrific as Rita. And Eve Ponsonby, they were particularly good because they got a lot of emotional energy through the play. So I think it's very rarely performed, but for me this made the play seem greater than I think it probably is considered in Ibsen's canon, really. What did you think, Tim?
I think that I'm probably not quite as positive about it. I mean, it was the first time which I had seen Little Eyolf, and it was quite rare to see an Ibsen play where you don't actually know what was going to happen. So it was quite nice for once to actually watch a play and watch how one of his plays unfolds, rather than just sort of watching it for the value of it being an Ibsen play. And I think I'd certainly agree with you when you sort of said it has a kind of thriller aspect. I think one of the things that Ibsen does so very well is kind of create these almost domestic thrillers, so that when you're watching something for a first time, you really are unsure how it's going to play out, and if there's going to be a particular bad guy or good guy within the characters. And probably what makes Ibsen so endlessly fascinating is there aren't really sort of good guys and bad guys. And I think what Little Eyolf does very well is kind of show how each of the characters in their own way are just rather tragically flawed, and that they're always seemingly having to fight against their flaws and trying to work their way through life as best as they can in a way which they can actually find to work. I think where I'm less convinced is really the transitions within the play. I found the first half to be, what is effectively the first half of the play before the tragedy, to be really superb. I thought the relationship between the couple were absolutely, absolutely bang on, and also just reflecting again on the fact that it does feel absolutely modern to have a kind of late era Victorian-esque wife sort of be so openly stating that they have this aspect of their relationship which isn't working and is getting within the way. I thought just sort of is very, very, very startling, and I thought it probably rang true for a lot of potential people who would go to see it. So it's remarkable that a play can sort of still have that resonance so many years later. I was less convinced with how it then all plays out, and I don't particularly want to sort of spoil the direction for anyone who is going to see it fresh, but I do think that the plot kind of zigzags back and forth in a way that I didn't find wholly convincing based on where the characters had been going. But, I mean, it is impeccably acted, and as usual, the stage and video design is solid. If rather, I found unspectacular, but I think that's okay with a play like this, where if there's anyone who you feel may struggle for a kind of daring, radical staging than possibly Ibsen deserves to be in its more traditional sense. But overall, I thought it was good, but not excellent. Tim, I don't know about your thoughts.
Yeah, I liked it for what it was, but the only slight problem I had was I was convinced that this had been cut and cut down quite heavily, and that it was normally a two and a half hour play and had been cut to 90 minutes or 80 minutes, because I kept thinking there was something missing, there was additional detail missing. I've actually gone back, I did go online and look at the play and translation, and I couldn't spot anything that was cut, so obviously my memory is faulty from the first time I saw it, and I think Samuel Adamson did actually make a play with two halves in it, so there's certainly a difference between my memory of the play and what we actually got. But I did think it was powerful in certain ways, but as I said, because I was so convinced that I was watching something that had been cut down, I kept thinking that they were in some way undercutting the emotion and not being quite as powerful as it could be. Obviously I just got the wrong end of the stick, and it led me all over the place and didn't make me appreciate it, because certainly what I was seeing was a very good play being played out very well, I thought. I mean, I thought it was very strong, I mean, certainly in the aspects of the design and the actors. I would say I didn't like Lydia Leonard, but it is really the character of Rita I didn't like. I mean, she is a very unlikable character, and she's not as well-drawn or as finely drawn as some of his other heroines, who are much, much stronger, and I think that is perhaps why we don't get this play enough, because there's just not enough strength in it. There's not the characters aren't really strong enough. There is a revelation that we get after the death of Eyolf, which is surprising, but you want to know an awful lot more about the whole family setup in order to get there. I mean, you do feel you know a lot more about some of Ibsen's other characters, and I think in this one we don't get it. I don't think I got enough character development in the end on this play, and I think that might have been a slight problem for me. But other than that, I mean, it is very well done, I thought, and in an accurate version of the play, it is a very good version of that play.
I think that Richard Eyre's got a real affinity for Ibsen, because, of course, he's done Hedda Gabler, and he did, was it Ghosts? And now this is the third, I think, all at the Almeida. And I don't agree with you about Rita. I think she's one of the most interesting characters he's written, because she's kind of less repressed and she's a kind of more modern woman for the time, I suppose, really. You know, you often learn facts when you go to the theatre, even though you've been going forever, really. And I hadn't realised that Ibsen was, after the obvious one, after Shakespeare, was the world's most performed playwright, which quite took me aback, really.
We're now going to talk about Ben-Hur at the Tricycle Theatre. This is a play written by Patrick Barlow, based on the novel by General Lew Wallace and directed by Tim Carroll. This follows on and is relying a little bit, I think, on the success of Patrick Barlow and Tim Carroll's previous collaboration, where Patrick Barlow adapted the 39 Steps for just four actors, and this is what we have here. We have four actors playing out the novel of Ben-Hur and giving you all the bits you know from, if you've seen the Charlton Heston version, you may be familiar with the story, even if you haven't actually read the book. It's actually possibly echoing a little bit more towards some of Patrick Barlow's old work with the National Theatre of Brent, where he would do ludicrously ambitious plays with a cast of just two. He would just have his various assistants, and Patrick Barlow, who would pretend to be a rather over-the-top actor called Desmond Olivier Dingle. He would have his assistants, who would turn out to be quite good actors in other things. His most frequent early contributor was Jim Broadbent, and then you have an actor called Robert Austin, and then another called John Ram, who I think is currently in As You Like It at the National Theatre. So you get some quite well-known actors have come through the National Theatre of Brent, this idea of, in that case, of just two people mounting enormous plays, and also getting a lot of the backstage mishaps that went on, and the arguments when they drop out of character while they're doing some rather complicated things. I mean, I think we have the things like The Messiah, The Greatest Story Ever Told. They did the French Revolution at one point. So the National Theatre of Brent were very, it was always that idea of a very small company doing something over the top. And Patrick Barlow took this formula and made a very successful move over to the 39 steps, but there was no backstage really to that production. It's all done pretty straight. They tried to tell the story all the way through, and while you only have a very small cast of four people, like in the case of Ben-Hur, with 39 steps, you didn't really get any of the backstage politics. And in this play, we do get a lot of the backstage politics. We are back in almost into the world of Desmond Olivier Dingle. But if you don't know that and you only know him from 39 steps, it might be absolutely meaningless to you, and I do wonder how successful it's going to be. This production stars are Alex Dunmore, Richard Durden, John Hopkins and Ben Jones. Webb Cowgirl, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, I'm one of those people who knows absolutely nothing about what these guys did before the 39 Steps, but the 39 Steps was one of my favourite plays on the West End for ages, and I regularly took out-of-towners to go see it to show them what you can do, basically with really good actors and a shoestring budget and a whole lot of imagination. So my expectations for this play were pretty high. I was expecting a lot of comedy, a lot of silly jokes, and pretty good pacing. Unfortunately, it didn't quite deliver on it, especially in regards to the pacing. The novel itself, I gather, is quite a bit long-winded, and while I went and rented the 39 Steps and watched it after seeing the movie, there's no way in the world I would want to read Ben-Hur after seeing this, because it looks like a story that just really goes on forever and is making these really heavy-handed attempts to link this story of two brothers with a grudge against each other to the story of Jesus of Nazareth. And while there's, you know, lots of fun to be had with chariot races and working in a galleon, rowing the boats and naval warfare and stuff like that, the scenes where it's turning towards the religious element seem really labored. And overall, it felt like it was struggling to find its shape. I was, you know, still really impressed by the actors. Richard Durden, who's the old man and also the old woman, is hysterical in his ability to shift from role to role, and really only equaled by Alex Dunmore, who plays all the women, or not, well, at least any scene that has a woman, she's likely to be one of them. If there's more than one, she will be one of them. And she actually, you know, she switched from costume to costume, from wig to wig, and from accent to accent. And I, not for a minute, lost track of who she was trying to play. So I think she was really a standout. Unfortunately, sort of story that the character, there's a character of the writer, who is also the actor playing Ben-Hur. His little side story is about his relationship with the actress. And this is actually what provides most of the forward momentum in the second act. And thankfully, once this started coming to the front, there was a lot more fun to be had. I enjoyed the big scenes. I enjoyed the crowd involvement. The audience and I were more than willing to laugh at the horrible puns, but I felt like they were really trying to take a formula that had worked before and not rework it substantially enough. My hope is that going forward, maybe they're going to trim a lot and tighten up a lot, but this verged on being boring, and that made me pretty unhappy because, you know, even though it was cheap as chips compared to a West End show, I still wanted to have, like, a really fun, lively night. And instead, it was just like, oh, another scene. I wonder what the shtick is going to be for this one. And that's really not what I want when I watch a play. I want to be sitting there, like, you know, laughing from minute to minute. This felt sloppy and, you know, not unprofessional, but just very much in need of tightening up.
I thought it fell a little bit between two stools, as it were. One of the reasons I mentioned all the thing about the National Theatre of Brent, the thing, stuff that Patrick Barlow did, was that he's always done this sort of thing, this idea of the backstage. You know, you have the fraught backstage relationships, and then also this ambition of trying to make a huge play or a huge ambitious play with a very few actors. You know, two in the case of the National Theatre of Brent and four in the case of 39 Steps and Ben-Hur. What he's done is gone back to that idea, but the thing is that Patrick Barlow, I hesitate to say genius, but he was absolutely superb as Desmond Olivier Dingle, this character that he'd created, this self-obsessed actor-manager who put on these ambitious plays, and he was so good at it. And I saw him play it, and it was just, he just switched it on and be utterly ludicrous, and it was done so skillfully. And I think that John Hopkins, who plays Ben-Hur and the actor-manager, he's not as committed, he's not as good at it as Patrick Barlow used to be. And you need that spark of genius that Patrick Barlow had of creating this self-important actor-manager. He's not convincing enough as that actor-manager who's trying to put this thing on a shoestring. And I think perhaps it doesn't quite work.
I don't think it's a perhaps. I think this is not working right now, and it might be able to clean its act up, but, you know, I mean, it's a nice alternative to Panto if you're Pantoed out and you just want to go for, like, a dumb evening with a few chuckles, but they really need to up their game, and having almost lifelike horses for the chariot just wasn't enough.
I have to say, I did have a good time. No, that said, I mean, there are, as I say, the weaknesses about the sort of the not getting that backstage stuff done. And yes, you get the normal shtick, which is the cheaply made play done in that over the top but very cheap way, which works quite well. I mean, there are also some very, very old jokes in there. There's a Wilson, Keppel and Betty sand dance scene. And I'm old enough to know who Wilson, Keppel and Betty are, but I'm not old enough to ever have seen them live. That's how old they are. They were a music hall or vaudeville act of the 1920s and 30s who took advantage of the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb to try to do an accurate recreation of Egyptian sand dancing. And of course, in the end, it turned into a very long-running vaudeville act, which probably had absolutely nothing to do with anything Egyptian, especially as I think they wore desert boots. And they had a series of Bettys, who were young women who would come and basically do a belly dance to distract people from two rather emaciated old men dancing in a rather peculiar way. So it's an odd joke to put in this play, but I'm glad they did, because I could get people to go and look up Wilson, Keppel and Betty on YouTube and see some very, very funny bits of video.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Assetto named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.